Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I'd like to introduce my guest co-host today, Dr. Catherine Koh.
Thank you. Great to be here.
It's great to have you here. Catherine's a resident physician at the University of North Carolina Family Medicine Department, while Dr. Christy Page is out on vacation this week. We miss her, but we're really happy to have you here today, Catherine.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. We have some great guests who we will be speaking with today, the first of which, Brad Wilson and Janet Greenberg, and then followed by Janice Wells on a segment about healthcare and serving the community.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to this. This is the kind of stuff that's near and dear to us as family doctors.
Definitely.
But I think it's near and dear to really a lot of our patients is about what's the role of patients being engaged in a practice in a today's healthcare society.
Definitely.
But first, we've got some research that matters. We're going to be talking about work and sleep. As a resident physician, you'll have some strong opinions about that, I hope.
Definitely. And then also, when surgeons say that they can fix something, is that really what they mean? Or sometimes do patients misunderstand what surgeons are saying?
We're talking about if you pluck hair out, unwanted hair, will that hair regrow or not? And then finally, about something that's you may know a little bit more than me, but we'll see what we can disclose here about liquid medical marijuana. We should maybe leave it at that for a second.
We could leave it at that for a second, and
we'll come back to it.
We'll come back to it.
Let's talk about our very first research that matters about work and sleep. Tell me about just you're a resident physician. People think residents never get sleep.
Mm-hmm.
Is it true? And then what's the sleep like given your various kind of crazy schedules?
Yeah, so it really depends week to week. I don't think there's a standard schedule of sleep pattern that I get. I'd say on average I get maybe 6 hours of sleep, and for me that I actually manage to function off of that. But every once in a while it comes in 2 hour chunks at best.
Well, and this new research, and Christy and I have actually talked about research that matters a lot about sleep and kind of worse outcomes when one gets less sleep. And this particular research looks at sleep and kind of income. And it's a little confusing because there's some research that suggests that the higher level of income one makes,
Definitely.
The less sleep one gets because one maybe winds up worrying about the sleep all the time. But then there's also research that says, well, if you hold down two jobs, neither job's a high-paying job, you're going to get less sleep because you're working so much. Both of them are the same thing. You're working too much.
Yeah, definitely. So one of the studies is called the American Time Use Survey, where the government researchers ask Americans what they do with almost every minute of every day, and they kind of break it down into how much time is spent working and how much time is spent sleeping. And one of the people really just said that the key to getting kind of more sleep is to live closer to your job and spend actually less time grooming in the morning is another way to get some sleep.
You can follow what sometimes I think a lot of the men do, but maybe a little bit better than we do it, which is roll out of bed and you're in the car in about 6 minutes.
Exactly.
It's not going to work fully. But there's also a nice, you know, element of not spending. It's if you're working more hours, don't spend as much time, particularly like watching TV.
Correct.
When one gets home and transitioning maybe quicker.
Yeah.
It's easier said than done, but it seems like this is really critical. Really for people on different ends of the spectrum but if you're working too much, you're not going to be sleeping as well.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Okay, well, let's talk about our very next research that matters. And you mentioned this particular one. It's some research about surgeons and fixing things. Have you ever had to have surgery that we can mention on the air?
I've had to have a couple of moles removed, more dermatological procedures.
Did they say they could fix it?
They did. Yep. They said, well, we'll get this taken care of for you.
Get this taken, which means fix. But that wasn't totally true, right? Because you had to go through surveillance because if someone takes a mole off, they're worried it could be cancerous or precancerous, and you have to go through a whole period. So it's not – when we say fix it, it's more than fixing it.
Yeah, exactly. So an example where someone might be able to fix something, for example, appendicitis, where there's an acutely inflamed appendix and needs surgery to be taken out before it gets into a major infection. You know, that's sort of an isolated event. But other things for example, like – plaques built up in veins and arteries. When a surgeon says they can fix it, a bypass surgery. When
or
they
a
fix
stent.
It, they take care of it for the short time, but that doesn't preclude all of the chronic problems that have already been built up and that need continue continued surveillance as well.
And this is some research that was looking at this, published in the Annals of Surgery, and it was researchers that analyzed 48 recordings of surgeons explaining high-risk operations to patients treated at actually three different academic hospitals in Madison, Boston, and Toronto. And the question was, how often did they say this fix-it theme? And maybe what is the take-home message for patients when they're considering having surgery? And I think one of the things was that this theme is used a lot of times, not completely, but a lot of times people's perceptions are when they see a surgeon, they're there to have it fixed. And perhaps they should be asking some more detailed questions like, what's going to happen after the surgery? What am I left with? What other things will I need to know, both surgically and like if you had a bariatric surgery to shrink your stomach or to do something for weight loss, there's a lot that needs to happen after the surgery.
Right. And sometimes taking care of just the symptoms doesn't resolve the underlying problem. So one of the people said that there are a lot of surgeries where we don't really know how well they're going to relieve the symptoms or prevent something bad from happening in the future. And those are things that aren't maybe discussed up front.
Well, let's move to our very next research that matters just for a short element, and that's here. This is about actually plucking hair. And I know this is probably something that goes across gender, that sometimes when there's an unwanted hair, there's a tendency to want to just pull that hair out and think, oh, that takes care of it. But these researchers looked at something that perhaps is a little different than normal. What tell us about this. What do they see?
Yeah, so what they were looking at is if plucking hairs can stimulate hair regrowth for particularly baldness. So kind of counterintuitive. You would think, well, if you already have few hairs and you pluck some more, are you really going to make more hairs? But this study found that when hairs were plucked in a specific configuration, follicles in the skin were prompted to send out distress signals that then led to actually more hairs growing back than were there before.
This was published in the journal Cell, and we must say, I think it was done in mice.
It was done in mice, yes.
We must say it wasn't done in humans. And don't go out there and just pluck that last remaining hair on a head there and say, you know, Catherine and Adam said it was going to regrow. Yeah. There's a lot more to be done here. But I think this could stimulate new research that could suggest both how to stimulate hair growth, but also to recognize that if you're trying to get rid of unwanted hair, may not be the best option.
Right,
because it lets all those follow-up hairs all around that know, oh, something stimulated, we should try to grow. And if you're trying to get rid of a hair, it may not work. Very last research that matters that is fascinating about this whole question about medical marijuana, in this case, liquid medical marijuana, and a treatment for epilepsy. Tell us what we should need to know.
Well, so earlier you had mentioned that I might know a little bit more about that, and that's because I come from Washington State, where actually marijuana has just become legalized.
Wow.
And in Washington State, as well as Colorado, they're actually seeing that they are able to dispense some of these forms of liquid marijuana to help people with severe epilepsy.
And this was a study of 137 people who completed a study. 213 started out, 12 different types of epilepsy, and they were given a form of liquid marijuana that can be made and to see whether or not it seemed to help the people who had really intractable seizures. And there was some help, but there was also some drawbacks. Right?
Yeah, definitely. So they did say that the drug, and we call it a drug because it was used for medical purposes, wasn't always easy to take. There were definitely side effects that they had to stop taking it for, particularly drowsiness, diarrhea, and tiredness. But it was very interesting and has some promise if we were able to do some more placebo-controlled studies surrounding this topic.
Yeah, and it absolutely needs a placebo-controlled study in this so we can really see experimentally because there are drawbacks and other kinds of issues that maybe they didn't report on. But it's going to be presented next week at a meeting of the American Academy of Neurology. Well, that'll conclude the research that matters. We've had a chance to talk about some research on liquid marijuana and epilepsy. Too early, but stay tuned.
As well as talking about balding and whether or not a new study in mice and plucking hairs can actually be a promise for the future.
About when surgeons are saying they can fix it, make sure the conversation's about the longer term things that you may need to know. And finally, about work and sleep. More sleep, a little bit less work. We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll be talking with Brad Wilson, Janet Greenberg, and Janice Wells about healthcare and serving the community. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Catherine Koh. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Catherine Koh. Today on Conversations, Catherine, we're talking with Brad Wilson, Director of Development, and Janet Greenberg, Healthcare Consultant, about healthcare and serving the community. A really fascinating topic, and we're so glad you guys are with us and gals are with us today.
Thank you.
Happy to be here.
Now, I must just ask a first question. I mean, this is not the typical show that we do on Your Health, but it's an important show, which is getting perspectives from those who are out in the community. And Brad, you're a development person who spends his time listening to people in the community. And Janet, you are a former healthcare executive who's a consultant who has spent decades in the community. Tell us how you got interested in what you have done professionally for lots of your life. How did you get interested?
Well, I was always interested in public health and financing and how people get care. And started my career basically on the managed care side of the equation, developing PPOs and health care plans and so on.
PPOs are?
Preferred Provider Organizations.
And so for our listeners who may not have heard of those.
They are a form of ensuring care where people have choice as to where they go to receive their care,
okay,
their primary care physician. And then I got really interested in elders and very, very concerned about how they were going to get the care they need with their multiple chronic conditions and failing health. And because I've seen all of those dimensions and based on my own personal experience, having last been running a long-term care insurance financing arm for a large national company, I became convinced that family medicine is the ongoing solution to a lot of our problems and something that people in the community and patients really need, and they need to know about it.
Well, we should say you are not just a long-term care and leadership at any company. You were at New York.
I was with New York Life.
We can say it.
I mean,
that's a big one.
This is a big one. Insurance
maybe the biggest
line
in the country, or certainly
right,
one of them. I'm sorry.
Right. I had full P&L responsibility for New York Life's long-term care insurance. And prior to that, had tons of responsibility for developing a lot of the early PPOs about 20 or 30 years ago.
And Brad, how did you get interested in your work in advocating? I mean, it seems like it might be easy to advocate, not easy, but for those with cancer, and we think about children and the pediatric, but to advocating for primary care in the community, how did you get interested?
Absolutely. So my background was working with nonprofits, and I'd done so in Washington, D.C., but largely in my home state of North Carolina. And most of that was in medical, developing new programs and fundraising for it. And I had the pleasure one time at a conference we were holding to have hear Warren Newton speak, the chair of family medicine at UNC. And the way he spoke, how he shared about the U.S. being at best 35th in the world when it comes to objective health measures, and how family medicine and some of the research out there, such as the Barbara Starfield studies, really pointed to a better way to deliver health care in the U.S., it really hit home to me.
So you wanted to see family medicine be a solution to taking that 35th in the world, moving it top 10 or top 2.
Absolutely, especially when you look at the fact that we spend vastly more than any other nation. It really hit home to me the way I internalized it. It was like paying for a Lamborghini and getting a Yugo. And really, we could do much better than we were doing. And this man really seemed to have his finger on the pulse of what we needed in the U.S.
So if we could all have electric cars that performed like a Lamborghini, but at the cost of a Yugo, there you go.
That's it. And that's what he was getting at is the really the best.
This is super exciting for me as a resident. I obviously really believe that family medicine is kind of the wave of the future and where we should go as a country. I'm wondering if you guys have any personal experiences, either as patients or with family members, that kind of led you to that conclusion as well.
Well, I myself have had some personal experiences, having a number of multiple conditions myself. And one of the things that I found was missing in my own care, and I'm a pretty assertive person, was the fact that I had no control tower. I had no doctor talking to other parts of the healthcare system and then aggregating all of that important information together and being able to really direct my care. Personally, I had an experience here at UNC where, unfortunately, I was admitted to the ER. And I was so reassured when my family physician was there. They wouldn't let me go anywhere, do anything, until my family physician took over, talked with the surgeons, talked with the radiologists, all people who I would not have been able to communicate to. And they were able to kind of pull it all together for me, get me out of the ER. And I felt so grateful that I had someone there who knew me. Most importantly, they knew me and they knew all about everything about me.
So you identify your family physician as your radio control tower, kind of overseeing the entire medical field infrastructure and how to navigate it.
Absolutely. And excellent. Everybody needs it because even me with my advanced degrees, I can't talk to a specialist about what's going on with me. I have no way of translating that into what I should do on a daily basis. But my family physician can do that and then can communicate that to me. And then there's a whole team of people surrounding that family physician who can help follow up and be sure that whatever I need to happen is happening. And guess what? That I'm doing what I'm supposed to do and that they asked me to do. So
well, Brad,
it's great.
Brad, I know that you don't talk just in financial terms, but for you, there's an emotional piece to this. Tell us about why this is emotional for you. What's personal about it for you in this whole game?
So absolutely. So not long after I heard Dr. Newton speak, I had two or three different family members of varying ages go through some very difficult medical problems. It was mostly around things that people couldn't figure out. And using Janet's term, they were acting as their own flight control tower. They were referring themselves to subspecialists and subspecialists. And every time they ended up in one, they were saying, oh, this isn't an orthopedic problem. It's a GI problem and vice versa. And so we were feeling very lost in the system. And I really put it together, that experience plus the talk I'd heard from Dr. Newton on what the problem was. We didn't have a family physician. So very quickly, we went and found a family physician for those family members, and they started serving as the point of contact and the referral source. And I got it. I really started to get what it could look like and how much happier my family was. And never mind, we were no longer attending very expensive appointments that we were paying for, our insurance was paying for, that were unnecessary and causing procedures that were not necessary. So I started thinking about that a larger degree. How could this impact my friends across the state? How could this impact people that I knew? And it really became a real passion for me. And so that is really what brought me to UNC.
You know, I think one of the things that we all have is that we all have this need when we're ill to have someone else advocating for us. You know, because it seems, and I, you know, like you said, you might have advanced degrees, Jan, but when you're ill, and I'm wondering in the work that you all do and the people that you see in the community, it seems like everyone, who could argue with the saying, we need a family doctor who specializes in you and is available to you when you need it. What's the problem? Seems like that's like a no-brainer. Is that a problem? Is that something universally known and understood?
Well, I think it's a problem largely because we've grown up in a society where we have come to value specialists who I have an extraordinary amount of respect for and who have saved me many times. But we've come to value them in a different way that we've come to value a family physician. And I think the public needs to understand how important it is to have a family physician. And I see that especially with elderly people who have multiple chronic conditions, don't have advocates sitting around them, and are frequently unable to express what it is that they need or what's bothering them. So I think education and people understanding the family physicians now are as highly trained as all the other physicians.
So it sounds like each of you didn't really know what family physicians were, per se, to begin with. How do you think we can educate the rest of the nation about what a family doctor can do and what they can serve and how they can serve patients?
So I do think as Americans, we think that primary care is easy. And the fact of the matter is, I can tell you, having now been behind the scenes, it is not. And so I think there's several things we need to do. So one of them is we need to make up for years of neglected infrastructure and research and innovation in family medicine. And that in part will lead to larger discussions and greater input from individuals and patients. So I think that's one area we need to look at. I also think we need to decide how we want our healthcare system for our children, for our parents to be. And we need to get more involved with being a part of that, much like Janet is.
And let me say something just very, very quickly. Having come from the health insurance industry, one of the biggest things that has to change is how family health care and primary care is covered under health insurance plans. That's the place where I think there's a huge need for greater understandings and some active political change and community input.
What would you recommend?
I would recommend that individuals in their health plans have much better first dollar or small co-payments in order to use family practitioners so they can get to primary care first, as opposed to these huge, long deductible corridors, out-of-pocket expenses.
You know, you both are making huge differences in the community, and these are roles that are perhaps softer. They're not so visible, perhaps, as the surgeon, but they seem like they're huge roles. I wonder if you might be able to share with our listeners, maybe in the last time that we have here, how would you recommend other community members, patients, non-patients, those who are believing in the vision that you are talking about, that we clearly treasure,
right,
but not coming from the doctors? How do people get involved? What do you recommend?
Well, I'll start by saying they can call me. So my telephone is 919-843-5112. And I welcome anyone who's interested in this to call me and talk to me. We have different roles that people have played. Janet has been in one of those roles, providing a lot of expertise and input. And so I think that's a great way to get started. But in your home communities, you can look for organizations that are focused on primary care and family medicine is a great way to start.
There's state organizations of family medicine, North Carolina, the North Carolina Academy of Family Physicians. But every state has this group that advocates for the type of care you're talking about.
I think one of the things as a consumer that people can do is start having a conversation around their dinner table about family medicine and how important it is.
It starts around a social activity, and boy, can we have a little wine with that one? Because a glass of wine might be good for you.
Okay. Absolutely.
Well, I want to thank you. This is really a start of, I think, an important conversation, and I know, Brad, you're very involved in really significant fundraising at the institution level to help support these things. And Janet, we can't thank you enough for taking the time and your volunteer spirit, but also this expertise and clarity of vision. We're going to need to take a short break, but when we return, we'll be talking and asking questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Catherine Koh. We'll be right back.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Catherine Koh. Today, we've been talking with Brad Wilson and Janet Greenberg. And today, now we'd like to introduce our next guest for this segment, Janice Wells, who's a member of our UNC Family Medicine Patient Advisory Council. Welcome, Janice.
Thank you. It's nice to be here today.
You know, Janice, you've had a really distinguished career in community service and healthcare and professional things before you came to this new role that you're volunteering and spending time with. Tell us about your professional career.
I had a career as a medical social worker at Upstate Medical Center in Syracuse, New York, and then I also worked at a tertiary care hospital in Atlanta, Georgia.
Which one?
And that, well, it was DeKalb General Hospital.
So. Oh, because I was born in one of the hospitals there. I can't even remember which one, but they were all good, hopefully.
They were all good. They were all good. And then in my 40s, I went back for a doctorate in social work so that I could actually teach social work to master's level students.
Nice.
Excellent. Nice. So it sounds like you're not originally from North Carolina. So when you eventually came here, how did you decide to pick the UNC Family Medicine Center to be your medical home and be a patient there?
Well, I like the philosophy of the UNC Family Medicine Center. It was consistent with my philosophy of care. And Sam Weir is my physician there. And he was telling me about the UNC Family Medicine Center's focus on becoming a certified medical home, and that as part of that process, they were seeking to establish the Patient Advisory Council, and asked me if I might be interested, and I told him I might. And so then
the rest is history.
The rest is history. That's right.
Well, you know, this whole idea of patient advisory councils, at some respects, they're completely new. But at another level, if we go back to community health centers from four decades ago, those were infused with community advisors. But I think perhaps in the last two or three decades, we may have forgotten that to have patients involved in the care that they receive, maybe it's not so radical, but how critical it is. I'm sure you must feel that way.
Well, I do. And I think our Patient Advisory Council is unique and different from many of the other patient advisory councils embedded in various healthcare programs. Ours is unique in that from the beginning, it was decided that we would be advisory to the faculty and staff. So we do not have an advocacy role that some advisory councils have, but we are more focused on helping to improve the policies, program services, so that we can improve the total patient experience and improve patient outcomes. So our focus is a little bit different and has been from the very beginning, and I think it makes it more exciting, and we're engaged and embedded in a lot of different ways
within the
program.
What do you think has been your greatest accomplishment as a group, as the Patient Advisory Council?
And maybe give us give us a list of several of the things you've been involved in.
Our committee has been, our council has been involved in numerous kinds of activities. We each serve on one of the committees within the family medicine program structure. We have given feedback to researchers who are doing research at the clinic in terms of asking them to pay more attention to the level of the reading level of their materials that they've developed, the kinds of populations they're serving. We've also helped give feedback about patient processes, things that work well for patients, things that don't work well for patients.
Can you give an example of something that didn't work well that you said, hey, wait a second, we want to give you some feedback?
Well, I think certainly we've talked about a lot of different issues like hours the clinic are open.
We started making the clinic open longer because you all said, you know, it's we need it. It's what the community needs.
Well, so that you have later hours in the evening and then there's some Saturday hours because there's some patients that find it quite difficult to get to the clinic during the normal operating hours. So we have found that the faculty and staff have been extremely responsive to suggestions. And we work more as partners with the faculty and staff because we're all focused on the same thing, and that's improving the patient experience.
Now, Catherine asked a question. What has been your greatest, what would you say, one of the greatest accomplishments? And maybe the greatest, a great challenge, too.
No, I think if you'd ask each one of our council members that question, they would all give you a different answer. But for me, I think the greatest accomplishment is helping the medical students and interns and fellows understand how important it is to really listen to the patient and to take into consideration what their perspective is. Sometimes the if you listen to the patient, you'll have better outcomes because you might suggest something that the patient's just not going to follow.
And how do you do that through that role on the advisory group? What specifically do you do that that kind of gets that infused? Because this is the unique element. We've been wanting students and residents to hear this for a long time. Mm-hmm. You must be doing something that's a little different that helps bring those insights home.
Well, I think that through the leadership of UNC Family Medicine, they've provided a lot of opportunities for us to interact with residents and fellows. They've invited them to come to our council. Those same students and fellows serve on these different committees. They hear us. They hear our perspectives there. And I think that the types of things that we share in those committee meetings helps them to think differently about how they deliver care.
Definitely. And we've also been really fortunate to have some patient advisory council members come and speak to us during our Wednesday conference time, Adam, and really share their stories with family medicine and how we can be better doctors. And
so
by
getting involved in the curriculum.
Yeah, definitely.
And then even in the clinic. And then what else? What's something else that's either been challenging or what are you dealing with now?
What are we dealing with now? Of course, the lean redesign.
Would you mind just giving a one-liner about what lean is and how that's affecting the Family Medicine Center?
Let's see. I think the focus is what Dr. Newton says, and I have to refer to my notes here, to produce the best outcomes with the at the least cost with the best patient experience in mind. And so the lean thing is to get rid of those things that are not working well and to enhance or emphasize those things that are working well.
So you don't like just waiting for 2 hours? There's not
value
added.
Well, I think that has been at the top of one of the things. And I don't think our faculty and staff enjoy having patients waiting around for 2 hours either, because then the patients become cranky and they're not very pleasant to deal with either. So it just I think that the most exciting thing for me has been to see that there's just been a total transformation in terms of faculty, staff, patients. As we've gone through the past year or two in focusing on working together.
I guess one final question. If you were advising patients in any practice around the United States or internationally, really, about getting involved in the healthcare center where they receive care, what would you recommend and what would you tell them the impact might be on their community?
Well, I would tell them to take the initiative to approach the director of the programs to let them know that there are patients who are interested in working together with them as partners, not as people who constantly are critical of practice, but as partners with them to help produce a better experience for the patients. So it takes someone who's willing to take that initiative and then someone who's willing to organize that effort and to stick with it until there's a council established.
Well, thank you so much. We appreciate that advice, and we still appreciate what you're doing at UNC Family Medicine, but also for this whole new field, it's back to the future, but it's an important return.
Yeah, thank you. We've been talking with Janice Wells, a member of the UNC Family Medicine Patient Advisory Council, about healthcare and serving the community. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Catherine Koh.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Calls segment of our show today, we'll spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
If you have a question you'd like us to address on an upcoming show, send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our executive producer, Erica Nori, to read us our very first House Call question today about someone with severe diabetes.
I'm in my 40s, and everyone in my family suffers from severe diabetes. Now, I have it too, and it's been pretty rough. I was afraid to start insulin for what it would mean for me and the rest of my life, and my diabetes eventually got so bad that I did have to start it. I feel so much better. I hope this helps others who are worried about starting insulin.
Well, that comment is one that we appreciate our listeners sharing, because I'm sure, Catherine, you see it all the time that it is a catch-22. You don't really want to start insulin. You'd like to start an oral medication, but sometimes you find that that doesn't work and you have to use insulin.
Yeah, definitely. And I think the statement about feeling so much better now that they're on insulin means that if they're to the point where they're needing insulin, the diabetes is relatively out of control and actually impacting their life potentially more negatively than they otherwise realize.
Yeah, and, you know, it goes both ways, too, because I had a patient recently in the hospital who lost 100 pounds. You know, great news. They were trying to lose weight,
right,
and they were getting closer to being not obese to maybe being overweight, and their insulin needs had dropped dramatically, and so they were actually able to get off their insulin. So being on insulin to start to feel better doesn't mean you're going to be on it all your life.
Yeah, and just highlights the importance of continuing this conversation with your doctor about recommendations and making sure that you're telling them how you're feeling. And keeping a close tab on those chronic illnesses.
Yep, great question. Erica, what's our very next house call?
I recently discovered a rash on my son that's all over his body, including his neck, back, and even his groin. These raised bumps seem to be popping up every day. He says they don't itch at all, and he's totally healthy other than the rash. He does have a case of mild eczema, but it looks different. Do you have any ideas on what this could be?
Oh, I wish we had a picture, Catherine.
Definitely.
You know, this is one of
those
things. Maybe we got to have a portal here that we can actually see pictures here, because rashes are one of those things you really do need to see a picture, but we'll have to make some thoughts. Any first thoughts that come to your mind when you hear this story?
Yeah, well, so I guess I'd want to know a little bit more about when the rash started, if he had been in contact with anything. You know, the fact that it doesn't itch makes me think less that it's an allergic reaction to something, Does anyone else have a similar rash, and are they going away or getting better?
Yeah, knowing that it doesn't itch is such an important piece here, because not only the allergic stuff, the infectious, a lot of the infectious things, the itis of the dermatitis, that inflamed skin, so scabies and contact, poison ivy, those kinds of things are much less likely. I guess one thing that could be is what's called pityriasis rosea. We call it PR. And it's a virus that happens, and you can break out in these eruptions, and it doesn't itch. And, you know, in that case, you don't do anything about it. So it could be probably to encourage you to maybe go see your doctor or take a picture and send it to your doctor.
Definitely. In this case, a picture is worth 1,000 words.
Yep. Thanks so much for your question. Erica, what's our very last house call?
I've been having stomach cramping and pain, and it got so bad that I had to see a doctor. She looked back at an old colonoscopy that I had and said that I had diverticulosis. She said that I now have diverticulitis and gave me antibiotics for an infection, and I got better. Can you explain how I had a medical condition and didn't even know it? What can I expect?
Yeah, wow, that is a great question.
The nerve of possibly having a communication that's not perfect to a patient.
Exactly. Yeah, so for clarification, diverticulosis is a small outpouching in the colon that most people have and is a very common finding, which is potentially why it wasn't mentioned, and it's very benign.
And I sometimes call that, I tell people it's like a hose. You know, a hose that's gotten kind of thick and out being out in the winter, and it kind of pooches out in some places. It doesn't leak yet, but it pooches out.
Exactly. And that does make you more susceptible to potentially getting an infection, particularly in one of those little areas.
Which we call diverticulitis.
Which we call diverticulitis. As you mentioned earlier, the itis, the inflammation or infection of the diverticulum.
And when that happens, you can get infected. And I guess what happens, you know, sometimes when you get a colonoscopy, you may not, you're sedated, and you may or may not remember if the doctor tells you, unless you get a written follow-up and you get written instructions. So I always encourage you, get a written follow-up, bring it back to your family doctor, talk about it with them, and he says, oh, I have diverticulosis. You'll know that, oh, you have these little weaknesses. They could develop in diverticulitis, and there's some things you might be able to do with your diet, maybe increasing some fiber, that might make it less likely.
Yep, definitely.
Well, those are some great house calls today, and we want to thank all of you for joining us today for your health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns important to your health. Please share your questions and stories by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Again, that's yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or our health app. Just search for Your Health, one word, with a free download.
We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guests today, Brad Wilson, Janet Greenberg, and Janice Wells. And a special thank you to Dr. Adam Goldstein for having me here on the show today.
And it's great, Catherine, having you as a guest co-host. We hope all of you will join us next time on Your Health on behalf of Your Health. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Catherine Koh.
And we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Thanks so much.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.